Okay, so the speaker today who's going to speak for around 35 minutes is Sandra Bloodworth. Sandra has been a socialist for 40 years now. She's one of the founding members of Socialist Alternative. She's also the editor of the Marxist Left Review, which is a journal that we put out, which you can also get downstairs. And yeah, Sandra will, as I said, speak for around 35 minutes. The discussion will happen after that. There'll be ample time for questions and discussion, so hold your thoughts for then. But I'll hand over to Sandra now.
I hope all this technology works. I was trained to do public speaking without a microphone and never really got very good at microphones, but I've got a bit of a sore throat. And before I start, I want to acknowledge this land is Aboriginal land, always was and always will be, part especially because I'm actually speaking quite a bit about what we have learnt in the last couple of decades about the First Peoples before the invasion. And I'll start with a diary entry by a cattleman invading the land along the Nilawa or Tongala, known as the Murray River to us, in 1843. He described in detail a fishing line of elaborate design secured in the ground beside an Aboriginal man, and a spring was forced open as fish swam towards it, and then the rod would flip the line up with the fish on it over the fish's head, and he would free the fish and throw the line back in. Now, this is what the cattleman wrote in his diary about this marvellous example of ingenuity. I had heard of the indolence of the blacks and soon came to the conclusion after watching a black fellow catch fish in such a lazy way that what I had heard was perfectly true. Now, this, of course, is not about whether Aboriginal society was collective or not, but I began with it to illustrate the ideological blinkers which make it so difficult to piece together a picture of pre-class societies. Industry, bustle, competition. That was the world of the entrepreneurs looking for a better life in the new colony. And the ethos of an egalitarian collective society collided with one of greed and competition. And as Europeans invaded lands around the world, accidental observers, scientists, most anthropologists writing up academic accounts of the societies they encountered, are coloured by this same cultural bias and a lack of, well, total lack, really, of imagination and empathy. And the trouble is they're still hugely influential in theories, both popular and academic, about what we should think about humanity. And living in this society, it's so difficult to imagine that humans can live collectively. We compete for everything, for school places, for jobs, for housing. We're told it's our own fault if we fall beside the way because we're too lazy or whatever. And this reality is backed up and justified by an all-pervasive ideology which glorifies competition, rewards greed, and takes exploitation as the legal bedrock of any decent society. Now, Marx and Engels' arguments that humans originally lived in collective societies free of class divisions and oppression has always been hugely controversial, and partly because it reflects a general hostility to Marxism, but also the very idea that society could function without rulers is anathema to the modern world, because after all, it raises the whole idea that socialism might be possible. And last century, it was actually in archaeology that the idea of social evolution persisted most consistently, partly because the human remains embedded in different geological layers of Earth actually showed pretty clearly that society had fundamentally changed and evolved through the ages. And then the radicalism of the late 1960s and 70s had a huge impact on thinking, and so the basic premises of Marx and Engels were less isolated. And so by the late 1980s, Richard Lee, a renowned anthropologist and archaeologist, a renowned anthropologist with archaeological experience, argued with little controversy. Before the rise of the state and the entrenchment of social inequality, people lived for millennia in small-scale, kin-based social groups in which the core institutions of economic life included collective or common ownership of land and resources, generalised reciprocity in the distribution of food, and relatively egalitarian political relations. Now, today, thanks to a whole lot of new ways of interpreting the evidence, we actually know a lot more about the existence of egalitarian and non-hierarchical societies. And two ethno-archaeologists writing in the 2016 Oxford Handbook of the Archaeology and Anthropology of Hunter-Gatherers demolished arguments which supposedly proved that women's oppression existed even amongst gatherer-hunters. So the first assumption they took on was that there was a strict gender division everywhere of labour, which meant that women didn't hunt. And they write, actualistic field-based studies reveal that the division of labour was highly variable and more flexible than is commonly assumed, both within and across populations. The division of labour occasionally followed lines of age, ability and experience, among other factors, rather than gender alone. And it is the case that in the last decade or so, genetic testing has actually revealed that the gender that has been allotted to a lot of skeletons was actually wrong, because they were allocated according to modern assumptions about gender roles, people's clothes and all the rest of it. And they conclude, a growing ethnographic literature documents the simple but undeniable reality that women also hunt for a wide range of animals and of all sizes. And importantly, an emphasis on the moment of capture and killing, said to be too dangerous for women who had to bear children, is misleading. If you think about the traps, the snares, various constructions that moderated the dangers and difficulties inherent in hunting, and they conclude the full repertoire of procurement technologies and strategies no doubt required the complementary labour of women, men and children. And they emphasise what follows the capture. Preparing food, clothes, implements, thread, much of which women could do when they were pregnant or breastfeeding. And they write, carrying the point further, one might note the predominance of women in manufacturing hides and sophisticated tailored skin, gut and fur wardrobes, which allowed hunter-gatherer populations to live and work in cold environments. Facile arguments about women's marginalisation and or men's high prestige tend to wither in the face of such behavioural realities. Now, there's also increasing evidence that egalitarian collectivity remained in the basic organising principle in societies which had begun to settle. And so I want to look at what we know, or some of what we know, about the people that were living here prior to 1788. And I rely heavily on two authors who have assembled a picture partly gleaned from descriptions from the first invaders, Bruce Pascoe, who wrote A Dark Emu, but mainly I drew on Bill Gammage, who wrote a seminal book, The Biggest Estate on Earth, How Aborigines Made Australia. And he also, using those early descriptions by Europeans, but also studied growth patterns in the process of propagation of eucalypts and other plants to interpret those early European views. And he also shows how changes in the landscape after invasion also reveal quite a lot about how Aboriginal society managed their natural environment. So first, there's the ancient fish traps, probably about 40,000 years old, some people say, a half-kilometre-long complex of dry stone walls and holding ponds at Brewarrina on the Barwon River in northwestern New South Wales. They're quite famous. They're arranged in an innovative way that allows fish to be herded and caught during both high and low river flows, and even through floods and everything, they've never been washed away. But what is less well known is that similar structures and weirs for managing water and fish flows existed all down the Darling River and along the Murray. And, you know, sadly, most of them have been destroyed either deliberately or accidentally. But even less well known is, and which is most relevant to this discussion, is that these traps encapsulate collective responsibility and shared access to the resources of the rivers. They were designed to allow breeding stock to continue up the river for others to be able to use them, so that then, and so they only caught the amount of fish that were needed for local needs. Different families or clan groups had responsibilities for different aspects, all coordinated to ensure that there was sufficient for everyone up and down the vast Murray-Darling Basin. And contrary to a lot of discussions, there were thousands of people living in that basin, and in 200 years the basin is gasping for breath now because of capitalism. And it's clear that communities based on collective cooperative production for their needs existed across the whole continent. Now, racists like to dismiss Aboriginal claims to land rights because, as Tony Abbott summed it up in 2014, before the First Fleet, Sydney was supposedly nothing but bush. And this is their justification for the lie of terra nullius. Aboriginal people didn't manage the land, therefore they weren't really a human society worthy of respect. Now, in my opinion, the desire for wilderness that is very common also flows from the same assumption, only this view admires what many think Indigenous society was like, living harmoniously in an unchanging landscape to which their culture simply adapted. And Gamage convincingly shows that there was no wilderness anywhere on the continent, on the whole mainland or in Tasmania before 1788. Actually, there's been no such thing, I would argue, as wilderness anywhere on the earth, probably at least for 20,000 years, because hominins had occupied the whole planet. But even before that, like various hominins, and especially the Neanderthals and then the Homo sapiens, had been shaping various and increasing numbers of ecosystems going on back probably 2 million years ago. And in any case, large swathes of what the invaders saw on this continent as simply wild grasses were the result of careful use of fire to control forests for animals they hunted and clearing for grazing, but also grain production and meadows of yams and other vegetables. The indigenous people dammed rivers, they cut canals to divert river flows and drain swamps, which, and some of it must have involved years of quite hard labour to carry out the changes that they made. And Gamage, summarising the research by a wide range of investigators, makes a convincing case for what to the modern eye we can call sanctuaries, areas where the law, Aboriginal law, forbade the killing of either particular animals or sometimes all animals in that area. So in times of drought, they could survive in that area, the animals would survive, and then as the rains came, they would spread out again. So it was a whole method of conservation. And one of the researchers wrote, "These sanctuaries were scattered all over the landscape. Wherever there was important dreaming, there was a sanctuary area." But of course it never occurred to the invaders that the gentle people living here could have sophisticated systems for survival which created the landscape that they described as park-like. So they were describing it as park-like, but they thought that was amazing because it wasn't anything being done with it. And travelling in Western Australia in 1839, George Grey described houses built with large-sized logs near the Gascoyne River, and he documented fields of yams that stretched for 5 to 6 kilometres and wells 3 to 4 metres deep, which were, in his words, executed in a superior manner. And he wrote, "More had been done to secure provisions from the ground by manual labour than I could believe it in the power of uncivilised man to accomplish." And because people couldn't believe it, because of what they observed, some people actually invented the theory that there'd been a previous sophisticated civilization that the present Indigenous people had destroyed. So the only way they could explain these structures. So the Europeans, they trampled structures and pastures, they stole the stones that Indigenous people used in dwellings and structures for managing resources and used them for the new kinds of buildings that the invaders aspired to. The Europeans built boundaries denoting ownership, so the Aboriginal use of fire became impossible because it depended on cooperation from one ecosystem to another, and the fences and the borders, the divisions created by individual ownership and competition, just got in the road. And so all the traditions of fire management almost died out, not quite. But even the people who know about it, you can't implement them. Now, defenders of Aboriginal rights often seem to think that all these discoveries of somewhat settled communities, houses, the fishing traps and the like, are proof that Indigenous people are entitled to land rights. Well, my attitude, and I think should be the attitude of anyone left-wing, is that they were entitled not to have their land stolen from them, and they're entitled to land rights and justice today, no matter what use they made of the natural resources and however they lived. Permanent houses do not denote virtue or entitlement. The reason that these discoveries that are of interest to us are that they show that it wasn't just nomadic foragers hardly distinguished from the apes who lived collectively, which is what people used to think. And Bill Gammage argues that the power of Aboriginal spiritual sanctions guaranteed that crops would not be interfered with by other clans. So they could leave an area knowing that homes and crops would be there untouched when they returned, and often they would travel very long distances either for hunting or for cultural exchanges, trading, social gatherings. And up the Darling, that was very common around the Warren. Thousands and thousands of people would gather there. And on the Mulligan River in Queensland, a drover described an Aboriginal store of at least a ton of what he said was delicious grain. And it was just there, and there were no people around. So his telling observation was, it was a pity we didn't take more. And so to this mindset, deserted buildings, which they described as huts and humpies, couldn't be houses, even when they described their sophisticated structure arrangement, because if they were permanent, someone would be there. You couldn't just leave houses and no one would steal them. And the invaders burnt and destroyed them, and they trampled the cultivated fields from which the stores that they were stealing had been produced. Now, there's the observations like this everywhere, and they lay hidden in diaries and letters, while at the same time their destruction of what they wrote about gave rise to the narrative, which is, like, even now still dominates popular and some academic knowledge of the societies before the invaders arrived. And that narrative begins with, you know, that there was a nomadic indigenous population, gatherers and hunters, who did nothing with the land. And this fitted, one reason it could take off was that it's fitted with mechanical academic interpretations of early societies, that foraging equals nomadic bands, land management and domestication of plants or animals equals settled towns, hierarchies and civilization. However, it has become increasingly clear with the new archaeological sites around the world and better techniques for interpretation that sedentism did not inevitably mean the end of semi-nomadic gathering and hunting, and it certainly didn't mean the end of egalitarian collectivity. Aboriginal society was quite typical, semi-nomadic and intermittently sedentary. So now I want to turn to how the earliest nomadic collective and egalitarian societies developed into settled towns and the social consequences over time. In the New Scientist article, in ACE New Scientist article in 2012, the author asserted that population growth meant we needed more food. So we turned to agriculture, which led to surplus and the need for managers and specialised roles, which in turn led to corresponding social classes. Now, some of this does correlate with any serious study of the rise of classes. That is, that it links the production of surplus and people who had to manage that surplus with the rise of it. But because without surplus production over what you need for everyday needs, how could some people be free of having to, you know, be involved in that day-to-day work, and which is a hallmark of a ruling class, who've been freed from the labour of everyday work? But the idea that humans just grew in number while carrying on the same gathering and hunting is pretty ludicrous, really. And we know from a lot of information that in many places, possibly everywhere earlier on, women actually practiced all kinds of birth control methods because the population, you know, needed to be kept to the level that was viable in the kind of production, methods of production that they knew. But the claim that they decided to make a huge leap into the unknown by somehow or other introducing agriculture is idealist and mechanical and has no explanatory value. So for a more realistic, complex explanation, I've had to turn to Marx and Engels and the actual evidence. Now, Marx and Engels argued that activity to produce the necessities of life is the underpinning of how humans live and think. And they wrote, "In acquiring new productive forces, in changing their way of earning a living, humans change all their social relations." And these changes will often be barely perceptible at first. And Engels writes about this in his book about the origins of the family and the state. But then if they continue, they begin gradually to bring about systematic changes to the whole social structure. But there's nothing reductively predictable or inevitable about the process. The response by individuals and groups can actually make a difference to the final outcome. And so there's what we call a dialectical relationship between technological know-how and methods of production and the social relations that are associated with that. And if you take the domestication of plants, it wasn't even at first a conscious act. A lot of plants changed under the impact just simply of having their edible parts gathered, and sometimes even using other parts for, you know, various ways in structure and weaving and things, until sometimes they couldn't regenerate without some human intervention. And so there became something of a pressure to learn how to plant the crops and then, to begin harvesting. But the process could advance very imperceptibly, often taking over many long years, like possibly hundreds, if not a thousand years at times. And at the same time, as Ian Hodder, the archaeologist who for decades oversaw the excavations at Çatalhöyük in Anatolia, which I've written a little bit about, I put something on my Facebook about it today, which is East Turkey, for people who don't know where Anatolia. And he writes, and this is about why people might have begun to settle a bit, "We can argue that the first agglomerations of people were closely linked to the sociality of public ceremony, feasting, prestige, status. From various studies, it's now clear that a central component of the process is that people came together for ceremonies and rituals and to control the alliances that were set up through them." And the development of settled communities took off at least, probably about 40,000 years ago in Europe, and it spread to many parts of the world over the next 20,000 years. And Brian Hayden in the Oxford Handbook argues, "The major watershed in cultural development was not the domestication of plants or animals, which was what people used to think, but the emergence of the more complex societies that first occurred among hunters and gatherers." Now, the evidence is scattered, and it's very accidental where you find places where archaeological sites can be dug. However, we do see qualitative developments around 20,000 years ago, when the last of the ice sheets melted at the end of the Paleolithic era. And so here we see dramatic climatic changes, both locally and global, can make, you know, have interact with the way that humans are producing their needs as well. So as the climate warmed and rivers swelled and coastlines receded from the melting ice, animal life proliferated along the banks and shorelines. It created new ecosystems with abundant resources such as fish, fertile soil, good rainfall and the like, which encouraged nomadic communities to settle somewhat more permanently, if not permanent, at least seasonally. And these developments, as far as we know so far, happened first on the northeast coast of Japan and the Ukraine. So they're the next couple of things I'm going to try and study up on to add to what I've done in the last few years. Later, it started to occur on the northwest coast of the United States in Anatolia, Australia, and along the rivers in Southeast Asia. And increasingly, in this, from then on, across the globe, humans were experimenting with burning, tilling the soil, weeding, planting, sowing, irrigating and draining the land, all gradually contributing to an increased productivity of human labour. And technological and social features such as sedentary populations, craft specialisation and the like had formerly been associated in academia with fully settled agricultural societies. But now we know that they are evident among many communities which actually still rely quite heavily or even primarily on hunting, gathering and fishing. And they could begin to produce a surplus over and above what they needed, which could be stored for difficult times and could begin to free a small number of people from the daily labour of production for their needs. And so, drawing on Chris Harman, the British Marxist, this is my explanation of how this then gave rise eventually to a ruling class. Well, the first thing is the surplus wasn't just seized by greedy individuals, which a lot of people like to argue, which again just reflects capitalist ideology, because with no state to enforce this seizure, why would an egalitarian society tolerate it? Originally, the control of any surplus was allocated to trusted individuals or groups, possibly families, sometimes religious groups, or individual figures. And we need to stress that any of these could have been women, because even people who make the argument I'm making, Marxists, assume that only men got control of the surplus. And I don't think that is credible, coming out of a society where women were not oppressed and there was an egalitarian, sharing of everything. So it would have been, groups of men and women who in those categories. And again, I think that allocating it to men is, again, today's prejudice. And these individuals or groups, they actually played a necessary social role involving reciprocal responsibilities, coordinating increasingly complex production methods, storing and distributing the resources as were needed, overseeing the implementation of technological advances, such as water management and the various things that people, new discoveries, what they could do with them. And for thousands of years, this did not give them any undue power, even though many of them might have had higher status and even some of them had extra wealth. For this group to actually develop the mentality of exploiters, they had to begin to identify the interests of the whole of society with their control of that surplus. And they wouldn't have necessarily thought that they were suppressing anyone to begin with, and neither would the rest of the population, because what they were doing was necessary. But there is also some evidence that emerging ruling groups could well have met with resistance, which is why I don't think anyone just seized the surplus. So to maintain their authority, to manage the surplus, they would most likely have begun to codify the obligations people had to them, the rights of members of the community, all in new ways to take account that they were going to be in control. And as they became more controlling, more entrenched by rules and laws, so the whole of society's expectations changed. Now, out of this process, gradually any challenge to them would have become a crime against not just them as individuals, but against society. And the Neolithic societies show a developing division of labour and a trend towards hierarchical societies much earlier than it had previously been thought. The existence of a stored surplus could even bring conflict with other communities that didn't have access to those resources and weren't producing a surplus. And so in the northwest of America, you see slavery existed when, right up until the invasion by Europeans. There was not a developed class society with an established state. But there is evidence of large settled towns which remained egalitarian and largely dependent on gathering and hunting for thousands of years. And there's evidence that developing hierarchies were actually resisted. A number of such towns in Anatolia were occupied by thousands of people between 10,000 and 7,000 BC, and one study of the diet of Kaonu, occupied between 9,400 and 7,000 BC, showed that it was mainly wild game, lentils and vetch, with no evidence of domesticated plants, until about 7,000 BC. So for a couple of thousand years, you know, they were settled in cities, but they were still relying on undomesticated plants. In Göbekli Tepe, 9,600 to 8,000 BC, it's thought that it was a ceremonial centre with no houses for actual living. And this suggests a high level of culture and interaction between communities over some distance, and some think that it might indicate the existence of a religious elite. But the transition to permanent state-dominated class societies out of all these processes was anything but automatic. James C. Scott, in his book Against the Grain, a lot of which isn't all that useful really, but I wouldn't recommend it as a book, but he summarises a lot of evidence about the history of early and emerging states. And the most popular explanation by archaeologists of why many of the early states ended in collapse, they usually list climate change, environmental degradation, and population pressures. And I think any of these could well have contributed to the collapse of the first established states. And Scott hints at, if not outright rebellion, then escape to surrounding communities, not subject to taxation and control by the state, as contributing to the decline. He says, leaving state space for the periphery was experienced less as consignment to outer darkness than as an easing of conditions, if not an emancipation. And he argues it would seem that this could well have been a better way of dealing with internal tension than outright rebellion. And a lot of the old cities that people might know about that are surrounded by walls, they were always thought that they were built to keep out marauding barbarians, but actually now some archaeologists think that they were more to keep people in. And the temple of Göbekli Tepe appears to have been not just burnt accidentally, but actually systematically trashed and abandoned. And the Turkish archaeologist Mehmet Ozdogan, who was involved in the Anatolia sites, believes that there was a social revolution about 7,200 BC, which overthrew an elite in Kaonu, followed by similar revolutionary upheavals around the surrounding region. In a private email to me in 2011, he wrote, "I am almost sure that there must have been some sort of social turbulence in that period, not only at Kaonu, but in most of the core area of Neolithic Anatolia." And Bernard Brosius, who studied Anatolian and Balkan Neolithic societies, agrees, and that he argues that this resulted in a class of society, Çatalhöyük, with traditions which lasted for at least 1,000 years. So now, I wonder if you also critique the widespread idea that collective pre-class societies lived in some natural state, as opposed to, you know, living by social rules. Humans have always been social animals, and the way that society produces its needs provides the underpinning for the beliefs, expectations, rules and organisation of every human society, and no human society is more natural than another. Gatherer hunters were not passively egalitarian, they were actively so. Aboriginal law ensured shared resources in an integrated system of sophisticated land and animal management from one area to another. Richard Lee said of the Kung San, or the Bushmen of Botswana, who he lived among, that they were still fiercely egalitarian. They would not tolerate anyone's boasting or putting on airs or trying to lord it over others. Such behaviour was mocked until the person showed appropriate humility. And he talks about if a man came in with a particularly big animal to share, he was expected to talk about how skinny and worthless it was. And if he failed to do that, which he says hardly ever did, others would do it for him and make fun of him in the process. And when Lee asked one of the elders about this practice, he responded, "When a young man kills much meat, he comes to think of himself as a big man, and he thinks of the rest of us as his inferiors. We can't accept this. We refuse one who boasts, for someday his pride will make him kill somebody. So we always speak of his meat as worthless. In this way, we cool his heart and make him gentle. Now, I've actually thought about that example because it is about men hunting. And I suspect it is the strategies of an egalitarian society that is being engulfed by surrounding class societies. And I've read quite a lot about the terrible impact that class societies have on gatherer hunters and others that were living collectively in egalitarian societies. Because their social relations change rapidly, and you see it here in Aboriginal society, which has not been the subject of my presentation today. And so I think that that could have been a strategy, particularly about the men, because they would have been being impacted by male dominance, and because often women became sidelined because of the impact of the capitalist societies invading them. But observations by anthropologists like Lee and Eleanor Leacock, who studied the Inuit society in northern Canada, indicate that hunter-gatherers actually socialised children in many ways that, you know, laid the basis for the kind of society we're looking at. And, you know, if you look at what the Jesuit priests who actually colonised the Inuit land, they disapproved terribly of these permissive and indulgent ways towards children, because the Inuit trusted infants and other gatherer hunters trusted infants and children's instincts, and so they allowed infants to decide, for example, when to nurse or not nurse. They allowed children to educate themselves through their own self-directed play and exploration. They didn't physically punish children and rarely criticise them. And there's accounts in Leacock's work that when the Jesuits tried to convince them that they should smack their children, they were just, like, shocked. They couldn't believe anyone would recommend such cruelty. They just couldn't understand it. And Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, one of the first to write about the Kalahari Desert people, suggested that these kinds of child-raising methods explained their moral character. Their children very rarely cried, probably because they had little to cry about. No child was ever yelled at or slapped or physically punished, and few were even ever scolded. Most never heard a discouraging word until they were approaching adolescence, and even then, the reprimand, if it really was a reprimand, was delivered in a soft voice. And she concluded, free from frustration or anxiety, sunny and cooperative, no culture can ever have raised better, more intelligent, more likeable, more confident children. And that's actually my little cutout for a handbook we can make when we get to overthrow capitalism and we need to begin to build a new collective social society. Okay, I'm a bit over time, but I want to make a few comments to sum up. In the 1970s, there were feminists and Marxist zoologists, archaeologists and anthropologists who studied the origins of humans and their evolution from the primates. And two prominent researchers in this field summed up a lot of the research. The picture, then, of humans evolving from the apes is one of bipedal, tool-using, food-sharing and sociable mothers choosing to copulate with males also possessing these traits. And this was their effort to try to sideline the image of man, the hunter, as the original humans. And but actually, their description really is about archaic humans. It's not really about the modern humans, but it, nevertheless, there's a connection between that and modern humans. And there's a lot of gaps, of course, between this original knowledge or knowledge of the earliest times and the first steps towards a class society. But I think, you know, I hope I've shown in this short presentation that there is evidence for those who are willing to look and see. Homo sapiens, well, the last time I looked, it can change within a month when someone comes up with a new theory, but it appears that Homo sapiens emerged from Homo erectus about 200,000 years ago at least. Class societies, of course, have written history, unlike pre-class communities, and so their history dominates our historical knowledge and assumptions about humanity, and we should not let that blind us to the 190,000 years or more in which Homo sapiens, the last in the line of hominins, and who interbred with the Neanderthals, who also had a very complicated, sophisticated culture, that all of them lived lives free of exploitation or oppression. And even after the production of significant surpluses, which freed a minority from the need to labour to produce their immediate needs, it took at least 10 to 15,000 years before egalitarian collectivism was overthrown. And we should remember that most societies never made that change to completely class-divided societies dominated by a permanent state. Until most of societies never made that change until they were invaded by capitalism in the media in the modern era. The history of this continent is clear evidence of that. The first people created a system to manage the land and resources based on a combination of intimate local knowledge with understanding of others' needs. And yet, they had no state apparatus to enforce any of this, or to coordinate it, or to impose the law. The whole culture rested on egalitarian reciprocity and respect. As Bill Gummidge concludes of this culture, instead of dividing them into gentry and peasantry, it made them a free people. And now, to live collectively again, we're faced with the prospect that we actually have to overthrow the exploiters first. So it's not as though it's an easy task, but if we want a decent, egalitarian, collective society, that is what we are faced with. But I would also say this new society will not return to the ways of the ancient world, because the natural world has been transformed so radically that actually that's not going to be the way. We have to go forward. We can't go back. But I think that we can be confident that we can, again, live collectively and use the accumulated wealth and all the technical and scientific knowledge which today is in the grip of the exploiters and the destroyers to find ways to regenerate the environment for the benefit of all and to make a decent life for anyone. When we could have a society where there is no class divisions, there's no oppression, there's no war, and we could actually begin to make a world that's worth living in again. And so that, for me, is why this knowledge of the earliest human societies matters so much. It's not just because of, curiosity and it's nice to have more knowledge, which it is, I find it fascinating, but actually it confirms that socialism is not just a utopia, but a possibility that is worth fighting for.